This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, there's been so much happening in my life, but I want to just, again, thank everybody for the wonderful emails that you've been sending me. I really appreciate them, and I just want to say that, I love your messages. I'm going to have our legal eagle, Bill Larson's going to be here in a few weeks and to answer some of the legal questions you've been sending in. I know that all of you are sort of working on your websites, and there are questions that are arising, particularly about using photographs. So he will talk to us about that. And in a few minutes, I'm going to be talking to, is Wendy on the phone yet? Okay, Wendy's here. Okay, great. I'm really excited to talk to my first guest today. Wendy Voorsanger has written a book that, I think it's supposed to be her first book. It's hard to believe. It is called Prospects of a Woman. And Wendy, hi.
Hi there. It's nice to be here.
Is it your first book?
Yes, this is my debut novel.
How did you do that? I mean, it is so accomplished that I know it said that on your website, and I thought maybe she was writing before, like, for 20 years with another name.
That's very sweet. No, I did work as a writer in the Silicon Valley for 20 years. I was writing about technology trends.
Yeah.
So I am a writer, but I think very different.
You didn't, no technical article ever sounded like this book, I can tell you.
Wow, yeah.
Wow. I've always loved books about the West, particularly. I lived in California, so I'm very familiar with the area, the American River, and all of that, and the history. And that's one of the most fascinating times in American history, the Gold Rush. So I was, thrilled to get the book. And as I'm reading it, there are just so many things. I was trying to think to myself what I loved most about it. It is an adult book. I want to tell my listeners right off, because it's I have a wonderful group of listeners who buy everything I even if it's not a subject that they are interested in, they'll buy everything. But I don't want to shock them too much. It's really a great book, but there are some parts in it that, for my more sensitive listeners, I just want to warn them. But this is...
Yeah, I think that's really important. That's an important thing to point out. There is some provocative material, and I think I appreciate you actually bringing that up, because I think it's important to let people know in case they're not comfortable or sensitive. I would hate to trigger someone.
Well, I've done that a couple of times where I'm an eclectic reader. I can read I read everything, and there's a place for everything. And the thing with this book, this is a book about a woman who has to come to terms with the reality of a very difficult life in the West in those days. It's not easy today, but in those days, it's particularly. And I mean, it's very true to life. And I think it is important to just tell, some people, at least they will be prepared. They'll know. It's particularly since it comes right near the beginning of the book, some of the parts. I just want to prepare them because you are so, and part of it is, I'm telling you, your writing is so descriptive. You can really, really paint a picture, and it's very visual. So, it's just, I wanted to get that out first. But you have the ability to, bring out characters and to describe things that really no technical writing could ever teach somebody to do this. And I wanted, this comes from deep within you. And I just wanted to say that, well, there's a couple of sections I wanted to mention, particularly, this is program is about people finding the joy of writing. And I want to read one little part that in your book. And I just, it's a section where she goes to town and to the little town, and she's the only woman there. And one of the characters says, "I must say, ma'am, you're a beam of beauty. Those green eyes, a solitary sight, bringing a man to tears, offering a bit of joy in the hardness of life, piercing our blindness with a rainbow of color." Now, that is such a good, that is so good.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, I collect quotes about joy. So that you said, offering a bit of joy in the hardness of life. I love that. But and piercing our blindness with a rainbow of color. Well, first of all, partly, of course, I think the reason you could write that is you were looking in the mirror.
Oh, gosh. That's so nice of you. Thank you. Yeah. My best friend also has eyes very similar to me. So.
Yeah. I must say, you have those kind of startling eyes. I always wonder how people must react to you first because of your eyes. They are quite...
They do. They think I'm wearing fake contact lenses all the time. I get that, like, multiple times a week. And I'm like, no, I don't have fake contact lenses on.
She's born with these beautiful eyes. It's just amazing. I mean, I wish we were on television because people would be just... But that you wrote that, and I thought, as I'm reading it, I thought, yep, she just looked in the mirror.
That's very sweet.
She has
well, you know, it. During this time in California, 1850, there were 20 men to one woman. So the women had a lot of value, and the men really prized them. So it felt very true to me.
Well, it's a great scene. It is a great scene. So let's step back, and I'll let you paint the picture of what this book is about, and of the you know, the. Talk about the main character and Elizabeth, and what how she landed up going west.
Right. Okay. So so essentially, my character she gets married on the East Coast. She's young, marriage, doesn't really know her husband very well, and they come out to the American River where her father has supposedly found gold on a gold claim. But they once they arrive. They realize that actually it's not exactly what their dad, what her father had said, and they find themselves alone. They have no more money, and her husband is not really able to, you know, help get food or anything, and she figures out a way to become the breadwinner very quickly, and it causes conflict in the relationship, and it goes from there. I probably shouldn't give any.
No, we don't want to give any spoilers, but she comes from back east. One of her childhood friends is Louisa May Alcott, and are you ready to? Can you read? Do you have with you the dedication or the Ralph Waldo Emerson dedication line?
At the beginning, in the first chapter.
Yeah.
Sure, I can read that. Would you like me to read that? Okay. So my character. Let me just set it up a little bit. My character. She comes from Massachusetts. Her best friend is the real writer, Louisa May Alcott, and she writes letters throughout my novel to Louisa May. And she was also given Self-Reliance, the book, by Ralph Waldo Emerson, which she carries around with her as she's in California. And she sort of uses it as a framework to figure out her life. So the each chapter opens up with a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson's Self-Reliance, and this is the first quote. "The power which resides in him is new in nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried."
Exactly. Okay, well, there's so much wisdom in that book. For anyone who hasn't read it, it's a wonderful read. But what I do love, I love books that have letters. I love letters. It's like you're peeking into something. You know, it's really I always like that aspect when a book has a collection of letters. Tell us this where this idea of having her be a friend of Louisa May Alcott came from.
Right. Well, first off, I wanted to explore sort of the differences between the young women or women on opposite coasts during the mid-19th century. What were their opportunities? What were their prospects? What were they doing? And so they were sort of a mirror to each other in terms of opportunity and what they were doing with their lives. And Louisa May Alcott was a very unusual woman during the time on the East Coast. And like you, I love letters. I think that letters sort of illuminate someone's real interior or a character's real interior life. And my novel is told in third person. So this was a way for me to sprinkle in my main character, Elizabeth's inner thoughts. But the interesting thing about letters in the beginning is she's a liar. So she lies. She's embarrassed about sort of where she's landed in California and sort of the failures that she's facing. And so she writes to her best friend in the beginning. She writes lies.
Well, that's what makes it so interesting. I think, yeah, what she, how it compares to her everyday life and what she can put down and think as she's writing it, how she's thinking about Louisa back in the East. And you're right, life was so different. But on the other hand, there were some aspects of life for women in California that were interesting at that time.
Yes. I mean, one really interesting thing that people don't know is there's a myth ingrained into our collective American consciousness that men in the West were strong and brave and women needed protection and were economically dependent on men. And we were happy being in a domestic role, that, you know, we were full of innate maternal instincts and maybe not really into sex. And actually in California, it was very different. During the Constitutional Convention, women in California were given more rights than any other state in America. We could own property, sign contracts, divorce, keep custody of our children. So that gave us a different agency in California to make our own decisions and to have independence.
And so Elizabeth Parker finds herself in this situation. She's got to take control of her life. She can't depend on somebody else taking care of her.
Yes. Yes. And the climate in California at the time allowed women to do that. It gave them economic power to create businesses, to sign contracts, to own land. And many women in California did that.
You must have done quite a bit of research. Well, you live right there on the American River, right? So,
I was born and raised in Sacramento, and I'm a native Californian. My boys are sixth generation Californian, and I did a lot of research, and I realized that what I learned during high school growing up about California history was wrong. Women were left out of the narrative in my history classes, so I set out to do a ton of research, and there's been a lot of academic books that have come out in the last 20 years about women in the West, and that informed my story, as well as a lot of first account diaries that I found in the Gold Country from both men and women. But the ones from the men were the most interesting, talking about how they couldn't get a handle on their women, and their women wouldn't do what they said, and they were very funny, actually.
Oh, I love diaries. They are so valuable, and it's a shame. So many people nowadays they don't do diaries, and they're just happy to do Facebook. But they are so valuable. I do research on a book about India in the 1875 era, and those diaries that the British people wrote are like, they're treasure troves.
Yes, I imagine they're very descriptive and illuminating about what was going on in their life at the time.
Well, I love to know that stuff, even down to, you know, how much they pay for things. That's so, so important, and the type of servants they have. And of course, you've threaded all of that information in the story really seamlessly. We learned so much. And as you said, it hasn't been really written about a great deal. And so I think people will appreciate this part of the story, that we learned so much about what women did and how strong they had to be.
Yeah, the women that I found were so interesting and really surprising to me. I had no idea, even, you know, growing up in California, but I knew something, you know, I love historical fiction about the West, and many of the female characters in those books didn't ring true to me because I lived here and I don't know those women, and those women weren't in my family. And so when I did the research, I discovered all of these extraordinary women. There was this one woman that was brought to the river who was a slave, and her slave owner was run off because California came into the Union as a free state. And she very quickly opened a bakery, and she earned enough money to purchase her son and her daughter-in-law's freedom from Missouri. And she ended up becoming one of the largest landowners on the American River. Her name was Nancy Gooch, and she's a character in my novel.
Well, there are so
many of the,
so many of the women
in the many of the women were based on real women that I learned about.
Well, I think it's fascinating, and as I said, I'm always so thrilled when I find a writer and find a writer with such talent and the ability to put us in place, whether it's the description of them walking to her father's cabin, that scene there at the river, it is so beautifully drawn that I felt like I was standing right there.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. It's a very special place, and I'm really glad that you felt like you were there.
Well, it is, and when an author can do that, when somebody can put that down on paper, it must really, there are so many sections there where little segments where you've written, the little segment I read there, that are so perfect. And sometimes it's hard to believe that, like, it didn't just come out that way. But I assume that it took you a little bit of time.
Yes, I have a degree in journalism, and then I went back to school and got my MFA, and I had to really learn to become a narrative story writer, because it's a very different sort of set of skills than writing about technology. And I had some great mentors and great editors in my program, and I have a lot of friends who gave me a lot of reads, and so I'm very grateful for them.
And of course,
I have brutal friends that told me when I wrote something that was bad, they were very honest with me. I think it's very helpful to have honest friends when you're a writer.
Oh yes, because they if they tell you, it helps you. It helps you to grow, and it's an essential part of this whole process of becoming a fine writer. And obviously, they've done a great job with you. They've worked. And you're getting these very well deserved acclaim that is. You know, when somebody can write like you, as I said, passage after passage, I found I would stop and I read the book, and then I went back and I said, yes, this is a perfect little passage here. And so it was thrilling. Now, I wanted to know this little opening where you talk about, I have it here, the rabbi, the quote from the rabbi. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, Rabbi Jacob Borsanger, my name is Wendy Borsanger, and Rabbi Jacob Borsanger is my husband's great-great-grandfather, and he came to California and was one of the first rabbis of Temple Emmanuel in San Francisco, and he was a Reform Jew and wrote this passage about what California meant to him. So I felt like it felt very fitting for my novel, and I felt like it was an important piece to put right at the beginning, the quote.
Well, I love it, and of course I realized that I was pretty sure it was your husband's name, and I was impressed with that, and I wanted to know more about him after that quote. I said, I now maybe the next book we'll find out more about Rabbi Borsanger. How about that?
Yeah, well, he's been written about quite a bit. There's lots of books that have chronicled the Jewish experience in California, and he always features prominently.
Well, I think it's just, again, as I said, it's so beautifully written. And tell us about your web. Oh, I wanted also to thank She Writes Press, because they always send me these wonderful books, and they have such good taste. It's it's always a pleasure when they send me a book, and I was so happy that I got to have you here today, because it's an exciting time when you have your first book released.
Yeah, I'm really thrilled. It was a long time writing it, and it's really interesting to launch it during a pandemic. You know, out here in California, everyone's very careful, and a lot of things are still shut down, a lot of bookstores. And I'm just seeing it as, I feel very fortunate that I was actually able to get my book published. So, yeah, and I'm very grateful to She Writes Press. It's a wonderful small press out of California that focuses on women's stories and women's literature, and they're fantastic to work with. I feel very lucky that they've published my book.
And they're great at promoting books, and so that's why they always get me hooked when they find me these fine writers, and I'm really impressed with your work. I know that you probably are working on another book by now. Yes?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm still very, you know, interested in women in the West, and I'm sort of kind of working on a different time period, slightly further along in the 19th century. But I'm deep in my research right now.
Yeah. Well, it came out at the perfect time. We're celebrating the anniversary of women's vote this year, 2020. My goodness, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. I hope it's timely and relevant in terms of what's happening with our country and sort of the opportunities for women right now. I read that last month, 800,000 women dropped out of the workforce out of only 1.2 people total, men and women. So women are really struggling right now. And it hasn't always been that way. So we need to remember where we came from and where we could possibly end up.
But women who went to California had to be strong if they were going to survive, and they did. And everybody can read about it in your book called Prospects of a Woman. And what is your website?
It's wendyvorsanger.com. And I also have another website that I am involved with. It's She Is California, and it chronicles all of the women in early California history.
Oh, that's great. She Is California. That's yeah. Okay, everyone go there. And before we leave, I want to read one more thing that you have, the inscription by Ralph Waldo Emerson to Louisa May Alcott, the book that she gives to, and I need to read this because it's a really great one for anybody who loves books. In the highest civilization, the book is still the highest delight. He who has once known its satisfactions is provided with a resource against calamity. And that's true.
Isn't that true? Yeah.
Just to be able to read, find that joy on paper of reading, and find that joy on paper like you have of actually writing a wonderful, wonderful novel.
Yes. Thank you so much. That is so true. I think we need literature right now to make sense of our world.
We do. And you've done a great job. And I look forward to having you back when the next book comes out. Okay?
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. And everybody, go to her website and look at her picture, because she's got these gorgeous eyes. Fantastic. And the book is available wherever books are sold, but probably Amazon or Barnes & Noble right now. Okay? Bye-bye now. Okay, we're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with two guests. Absolutely fantastic. This is so exciting. And the book is called What to Eat When Cookbook, and it is part of the What to Eat When plan, and it is amazing. I have just been having so much fun reading this cookbook, and I've tried out three of the recipes so far. And so I'm so happy to welcome to the program two doctors. Well, Dr. Michael Rosen and Dr. Michael Krupain. Hi, guys.
Hi, Patsy.
Okay, well, where do we start? This is so much fun. I love getting this cookbook. I tell you, this anybody who says I can have spaghetti for breakfast is a friend of mine, because that's my favorite. Cold spaghetti is my favorite breakfast.
Well, you're doing it right. That's Dr. Krupain's favorite, too. But, in fact, what happens when you have whole grain pasta when it's hot, it creates a lot of sugar from the starch. But when you cool it overnight, and so you can cook it at night and cool it overnight, that's the natural way of doing it, and have it in the morning, a lot of that starch turns into what we call resistant starch. And that really serves as fiber rather than a direct source of sugar. So it's a much healthier thing for you and for your gut, because it feeds those gut bacteria. But I should let Dr. Krupain talk about this even more, because he made a lot of the pasta recipes, or created a lot of the pasta recipes in the book, because pasta is one of his favorite foods.
Yeah, pasta is my favorite food, and the new What to Eat When cookbook is filled with pasta recipes, as you probably saw. I'm staring at one right now, which is a very simple one, which is a whole grain penne with tomato and basil, just simple cherry tomatoes, a little salt. You don't even have to cook it. You can eat them raw, which makes it even easier. We have lots of great pasta recipes here that are all combined with all different vegetables and different pestos and different simple sauces, so you can enjoy pasta. I know a lot of people are afraid of pasta right now, but we don't think you have to be, especially when you eat it cold.
And eat it in the morning. That's it, because
that's right.
The whole subject is when to eat, and what to eat and when. And I want to just give a shout out to the chef who taught you to cook, Silvestro Silvestori. I love that name so much. I'm going to write a book just so I can use that as a character's name. I mean, it's so perfect. Silvestro. Silvestori.
Well, he's a real person.
Yeah, we could talk about Silvestro for a long time. But Silvestro's out in Puglia, and Puglia is an amazing part of Italy. And I went to cooking school in Puglia, and Silvestro is still a good friend of mine. And what's really cool about Puglia and the cuisine there is that it's very vegetable-centric and very whole-grain-centric. Sort of naturally, they make their pasta with whole grains, and they eat mostly vegetables and not a lot of meat. And that's exactly the right way we should all be eating. And that's why we created, again, the What to Eat When cookbook, to teach people how to cook with those ingredients so they could eat more of them.
We were going in November, scheduled for this November. It's delayed a year, but we were scheduled for this November to teach a cooking course with him. Mike and I doing the science, and Mike and Silvestra doing the cooking and the teaching, me doing the eating. But in essence. So, Patsy, since you're so well syndicated, we should put a plug in. So if you write to Dr. Coupain at wenway.com, he'll show you how to get in on that cooking course.
Yeah, the cooking course, the school is called The Awaiting Table, so it's theawaitingtable.com, and our course is How to Eat and Drink to Be 100, and we hope to be able to do it next spring if we're all able to travel again.
Well, that's a great idea because, yeah, I hope so. Everybody will be able to travel because it is a lovely area of the country and a wonderful place to go. And I would just love to meet Silvestro. I think it's a fantastic name. And, of course, Dr. Rosen, you have a mother-in-law who was 100?
That's very good. She's actually 101. She lives alone, still functions very well. And normally we go on her birthday. We went on her 98th or 99th and her 100th birthday to the Cleveland Indians baseball games because she loves baseball. And, in fact, one of the players comes up and down her 100th birthday, gave her an autographed ball He won the Cy Young Award that year. This year we were going to go on her 101st birthday. We had tickets, and, of course, her name appeared in lights on the for only the players to see this year and TV cameras. But in any case...
Well, you'll have to go for 102. You'll have to get her back in the stadium.
That's it.
But anyway, and she does like a lot of this food and does cook it. So we gave her an early edition of the cookbook, and, in fact, one of her favorite recipes is the carrot crema that Michael came up with, but it's so easy to make, and you just eat vegetables, and it makes sandwiches moist. So tell her how you do the carrot crema.
Well, the carrot crema is a really simple recipe. We actually have a bunch of different what we call crema recipes in the book, and the idea is you can take a vegetable, sort of concentrate it, and turn it into something very creamy and satisfying, like cheese would be.
Well, the carrot crema and the artichoke crema.
That's right. The artichoke is my favorite. We've got the carrot, which is beautiful, and the corn is actually really great, too. And the carrot one is the easiest of them all. It's basically roasted carrots that you puree in a Vitamix blender with olive oil. You can top it with some walnuts if you want, or a carrot top pesto, which is my other favorite way of using carrots. One of the principles of eating the way we describe it is that you shouldn't stereotype food. So we talked about eating pasta for breakfast. That's my favorite breakfast and not a normal thing people would eat. But if you don't stereotype food, it could be a normal thing. Mike's favorite breakfast is salmon burgers. He'll tell you about that.
Salmon burgers topped with walnuts. So you get healthy fat of the walnuts and of the salmon burgers.
Of course. But in the carrot top pesto, we don't want you to stereotype your vegetables either. So most people think you have to throw carrot tops away, the green part, but you don't. They're actually delicious. They're filled with nutrients. You take off all of the little fronds, and you put them in a food processor with some toasted walnuts, with a little bit of garlic, and with a little bit of olive oil, and you create a pesto that you can use to make another pasta dish, or you can put on top of your carrot crema or on top of your roasted carrots. And now you're eating what I like to call root to stem, which is eating the whole plant.
Well, explain the idea behind it, about the timing, why it's important to eat at different times of the day instead of what we're sort of normally doing today.
Yeah, so this is a big principle that we wrote about in the first book, and it really has to do with your circadian rhythm. And your circadian rhythm is your body's clock, and it's set by the sun. And it runs on a 24-hour cycle, and its job is to get your body to run efficiently, to get everything ready to do the right thing at the right time. And we all know about our circadian rhythm when we get jet-lagged, right? We travel somewhere, the sun comes up at a different time, and we're just dragging through the day because our body clock is off. Well, it also controls our metabolism. So our metabolism actually changes throughout the day, and our metabolism is set up to want us to eat more early and less later. In fact, the type of fuel our body prefers carbohydrates more early and fat more later. Our body burns calories differently early and later. So a calorie in the morning actually doesn't count as much as a calorie later in the day. And so based on these principles, we created some ideas that you could live by, and they're not, it's not sort of a diet, it's a way of life. So you eat more early and less later. And that means you eat breakfast and lunch as your largest meal of the day and dinner as the smallest, and then you only eat when the sun is up. So when the sun is set, you stop eating or you fast, right? So you would get about 12 hours of fasting on average. If you can stretch it out a little more to 14 or 16 hours, it's even better. And that's when you're fasting, your body is using its stored energy, and that's called intermittent fasting. Now, real fasting is really hard, but intermittent fasting is actually really easy since most of the time you're asleep. But we've learned that there's a lot of people who are doing intermittent fasting not quite the right way. A lot of people are eating dinner as their largest meal of the day, and they're not eating all day, and then they get to dinner and they have this huge meal. That's not the best way to do it, because we said you want to eat more early and less later. And then people are focusing on that time and that fasting and not eating certain times of day, but they're not focusing on the what they eat. And so that's why we wrote the new What to Eat When cookbook, because you have to focus on both. We wanted to bring the science together of the when, the circadian rhythm, with the science of the what, the food you eat, so you could really maximize your health benefits.
Well, it's a fascinating idea, and as I was reading it, I said to myself, you know, there's so much logic, simple logic behind what you're writing, that once somebody sort of embraces it, I think that it makes life so much easier. And one of the things that I love when you talk about cooking, like at night, or my mother-in-law was wonderful in that she would cook on Sundays. One day she would cook so that the food would be there, everything from, you know, onions and green peppers and all of those good things, but she would cook it all up on Sundays. And so all week long we didn't have to cook. We could just take things from the refrigerator and you know, warm them up, and or not warm them up in the case of like the spaghetti. It just makes life so much easier.
Well, in fact, one of the great recipes that Michael, Dr. Croupain, constructed, made, created, was the Wenwei black lentil soup. And in fact, you can make huge amounts of it on a Sunday, as I've done. So it freezes well as stores in the refrigerator well. So he has it for a week. I have it for a month at a time, because I make a huge batch and then freeze parts of it. So that's exactly what we do. So, Patsy, I agree with you. You're right on. Let me go and talk a little bit more about the health benefits, though, of intermittent fasting. When you go through that 16-hour period, you become a little ketotic. That changes which of your genes are on. So we have switches for our genes that turn them on or off. And ketosis turns on genes that create a repair mechanism. You turn on what we call anti-inflammation genes and your repair genes. And then when you re-eat again in the morning, and as I said, I think my favorite breakfast food is a salmon burger that's walnut crusted, because I love the healthy fat and the crush and the crunch of the walnuts with the salmon. When you eat that in the morning, then you turn on your growth or your young cell mechanisms, so you actually physically become, your cells become younger by doing that process. And every biomarker, literally in 4 days, every biomarker of aging, of cardiovascular disease, the precursors, biomarkers of cancer and of dementia, all diminish and improve as you go through this in just 4 days. So what I say to people who say, how tough is this? It's really pretty easy once you say, I'm going to do it for 4 days. Because in 4 days, you will feel less hungry at night, you'll sleep better, and you'll feel more energy, in addition to all your biomarkers of health improving.
So what's the time? Repeat the time schedule. You would eat at, like, what time
and how many hours not to eat? Well, I eat from about 11 a.m. to about 6:30, so I get about 16 and a half hours of fasting a day. Now, one of the things I did is I measured my own ketones, but whether you do that or not, you're getting ketotic by the end of that period, and that makes you healthier. Mike, what's the period you eat?
Yeah, so I'm a little extreme. So I eat around 9 a.m. I have a nice big breakfast. Then I'll eat lunch probably around 2 or 3, and then I actually maybe not even eat dinner, because I've eaten such a big breakfast and lunch that I'm not hungry, but sometimes I'll eat another little snack around 5, some walnuts or some yogurt or something, and then fast until the next morning.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, it's not as difficult as people would imagine. I think if you once you get into that the sort of swing of things, it works. And particularly if they make some of these recipes, because there are some recipes in here that absolutely amaze me. Well, first of all, I love anything with cashews. And one of my favorite meals is...
Did you make the cashew-naise?
Oh, yes. I made cashew-naise, and I made... what's the other one I made? The other day I made it because I just had to try it.
I could not believe the mousse.
I throw cashews in rice. I throw cashews wherever I can throw a cashew, I'll throw one. And with the mousse, I could not believe that the mousse could taste good made with water. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I didn't believe it. I had to do it myself. And it's incredible.
I can tell you the first time I did it, so that was Dr. Croupain's recipe, and the first time I did it, I couldn't believe it either. And the first time Chef Jim Perko is the third author, who's the executive chef at the Cleveland Clinic Wellness, and the first time he made it, we actually called Dr. Croupain on the phone.
I remember they called
to tell him, we can't believe how great this is.
Yeah, and what's really cool about it, you know, we always make mousse or things like that with eggs and cream, and those things are delicious, but they mask the flavor of the chocolate, right? So when you use water as the sort of agent in making that mousse, you taste the chocolate so much more.
Oh yeah, I didn't have any Grand Marnier, but I did have Godiva liqueur. And that worked just as well. And whoa.
Yep, it will.
And yeah, you can flavor the chocolate with anything.
Since you made the cashew naise, try the mushroom BLT. It is mushroom LT. It is sensational. It is my second favorite main course in the whole book. So there's a mushroom MLT. That's better than any other BLT.
The photography is wonderful. And you mentioned, let's talk a little bit about Jim Perko, because he is quite a guy.
Oh, he's a wonderful guy. He believes that his mission is to teach physicians how to teach cooking to the patients. So he takes the culinary, he calls it culinary medicine, and in fact we have a culinary medicine shared medical appointment at the Cleveland Clinic, and in addition we teach medical students how to cook, and he even taught a old doctor, me, how to cook much better, and in fact in the book is a large section on techniques, because he believes that anyone should be able to cook healthily food that tastes great and that is good for them. So the key point is food is a relationship. You wouldn't marry someone who is trying to kill you. You shouldn't eat food that's trying to kill you. So you should eat food that tastes great, and that's why we put so much emphasis on technique. And as Chef Perko says, and he was an Olympic chef, if you will. I didn't even know there was a Chef Olympics. But he was an Olympic chef trained at the Culinary Institute of America. But, in fact, he always says that the most important ingredient in any recipe is the technique with which it's created. And so that's why we have this section on techniques. So you don't have to be a polished chef. You can be a total amateur like myself and learn to cook healthily. And there are a whole bunch of tips in there, such as how to really cook vegetables so they taste much better and so they absorb the sauces, like that great carrot pesto that Dr. Croupain was talking about, and even the carrot crema. So they're really, that emphasis on technique is in the book.
Well, Dr. Croupain, I want to ask you a serious question here, because it's been bothering me for quite a few years, and it's really... Now, you went to school, and you were going to be a neurosurgeon. When you decided that it wasn't for you, and you switched over to preventive medicine, which is so important, I am still wondering why doctors, I have not yet run across a doctor, and whether it's for myself, my husband, my sister, any of my relatives, I have not met one doctor. None of us have ever gotten you know, with some, we've moved to different towns and we've got new doctors. Not one of us has ever gotten a doctor who ever talks about preventive medicine. I mean, nothing. They wait until you're sick and then they give you a pill. But I have not had one doctor who actually taken 10 minutes and sat down and say, this is what you should be doing. This is how you should, you know, look at life and the way you live. How many doctors are you putting through your school? I hope that you're really building a whole big, giant team of doctors who are going to change the way that medicine is being handled right now. Because if people would learn this when they start going to a doctor, their life could be so different.
Well, yeah. Patsy, I'm going to take that rather than Dr. Krupa.
That was my question.
Okay, I would have taken, but that's what I do full time, is do preventive medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. So I'll let Michael.
I was going to say that. Yeah. So preventive medicine is a very special specialty. Not enough people go into it, and not enough doctors have been focused on the lifestyle factors that impact your life. But preventive medicine and lifestyle medicine, which Mike again practices every day, can really make a big difference. And this is again why Mike and I are so passionate about the What to Eat When cookbook and What to Eat When, and all the work we do in the media and with individuals to try to help them focus on those lifestyle factors and eating the right foods and eating them at the right time so they can, you know, prevent disease and even reverse disease.
Well, I think that we are really being, as a society, we are being cheated in a way because we don't have the doctors who actually teach preventive medicine. They wait until they have to give you a pill, and it's wrong. They should really be working from day one. The minute a patient comes to them, they should be examining this important lifestyle things that are can change the entire future.
We totally agree with you, and so that's the whole gist of why the Wellness Institute at the Cleveland Clinic was born. So I don't know where in the country you are, Patsy, but
I'm in Clearwater, Florida, and of course we have a lot of seniors here, and a lot of people visiting doctors all the time, and getting more and more pills. And so much of this could be overcome if they knew some of this stuff. And the Cleveland Clinic, since you work there, I'm telling you, you really should do like a franchise of the Cleveland Clinic all over the country, where the first thing when people walk into the door, this is what they learn. This is the kind of thing they learn. And
well, we are on the east coast of Florida, not on the west coast or the northern part, but we are on the east coast of Florida, and so
I think the first thing that happens when they should come through the door is they should get a copy of the What to Eat When cookbook.
If they get the What to Eat When cookbook is all about prevention.
And a simple thing like this idea of when what to eat when, and the fasting, the value of it, fasting for a certain number of hours, it's important, and it's I think it's just so, well, I would say it's like clever that somebody's finally come out with something like this, because this has not been done, really.
Yeah, well, you know, the science behind understanding our circadian rhythm is a young science, actually. Someone won the Nobel Prize for just a few years ago, understanding the circadian rhythm. And even Mike and I didn't really know that much about it until a few years ago when we really started digging into it, and that's when we understood it. That's what made us want to write these two books. But, you know, I think that's a pretty cutting-edge and new idea, even though sometimes we say, you know, it feels like common sense, or it's what your grandma told you to do or your mom told you to do, which is always annoying when your mom is right sometimes. But the science has now shown that all that advice is actually true and valid. And so it's really exciting, and that's why we wanted to tell everybody about it.
Well, it's a beautiful book.
It's exciting that you're talking about it, Patsy.
It's a wonderful book. I'm so happy to promote it. People, get this now, and you'll be ready for Thanksgiving. You might still be able to add your turkey, but there are so many of the other dishes, the squash, the ones for the cauliflower, even I could eat the ones for the cauliflower. So people, it's a wonderful book to get here at just now here. We're getting towards Thanksgiving and so many recipes here for vegetables in the fall. It's a wonderful book, and I am so really happy that you came on the program today. Dr. Michael Rosen and Dr. Michael Krupain. And what's the website where people can find out more?
Well, the website is whenway.com, and people can pick up the What to Eat When cookbook anywhere where they like to buy books.
Okay.
I'm going to give you one more trick on the turkey, and that is go to walnuts.org. At the walnuts.org website, Molly Kasten and I created a healthy way of making turkey and of a turkey dinner, so that can supplement this. It's not as the recipe is a little more liberal on the what than in the What to Eat When cookbook, but it is a great recipe. That's at walnuts.org, and look for their turkey recipe. But in the meantime, as Michael Krupain said, this you can find out more about it at whenway.com.
Okay, well, thank you guys for being on the program today. I think you're going to change a lot of people's lives and make them longer. So you've done a great job here.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Woo! It is a beautiful cookbook. Absolutely beautiful. I'm sending it to my son. Because what I know he'll love it, because the recipes are easy. Particularly, some vegetables I don't eat very much, but he loves vegetables. I'm so happy that he loves vegetables, and all of these. There are some recipes in here that just absolutely surprised me. Particularly, as I said, the chocolate mousse. You won't believe it. You can make it with water. I made it. I said, this is a joke, but it was fantastic. Anyway, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or if you're lucky, a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. And National Novel Writing Month is coming up in November. Check it out, NaNoWriMo, and you will enjoy it. And everybody, if you have any questions, contact me at radio-joyonpaper.com. And make sure that you mark your calendars on October 29th. Lee Child and Andrew Child will be on Joy on Paper. Thank you, everybody. Oh, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room very quickly. Thank you, Ed. And he saluted me, and I saluted him, and I wish I had been a general. I would have been such a good general. Okay. Bye-bye now, everybody. Bye.